Okay. Hi, everybody. Thank you for coming today. It's my pleasure to invite here today Aaron Stanton and Marlee Skeen, who are coming from the VR Institute of Health and Exercise and also from the San Francisco State University. I think they have a very interesting background. Aaron worked on classifying ebooks on an automatic way. Their tool was widely used globally and later was acquired by Apple. And he's now focusing in a different type of content. He's looking at VR and how can we classify VR. He found out, and Marlee's joined in that effort, that virtual reality can be a sort of a gym. Some of the activities that we perform there are very exercise-like. And in particular, they were looking at this audio shield game, in which people have been playing for over 700,000 hours. And so they have developed this tool to explore in a more methodological way how many calories are you actually burning in VR. I think this talk also gains a bit more of attention these days. We are seeing how content in VR, it's hard to classify, and I think it's interesting this effort, so I'm happy to have them here. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. thank you very much. So I'm going to start in a second by introducing Dr. Kern as well, because we actually built into our presentation our own introductions, and so I'll go with that direction as well. But I'm going to start by saying I'm actually not a very good presenter, but I like to think I'm a relatively decent conversationalist. So I would appreciate it, actually, if you guys have questions, feel free to interject and ask. And if you guys don't mind, could I ask you to move forward so that, like, we're all close enough that we can be more conversationalist-like? It will help my nerves. You're still allowed to totally work on the laptops. That's fine. But this is actually something that's a lot of what this conversation is going to be about is social norms and things like where you sit in the room and how that interacts how that affects social interactions is fascinating to me. So I think it's very fascinating that nobody is in the actual front row except for us. So my name is Aaron Stanton. And Dr. Kern, if you would like to talk about your background at all, or do you feel the introduction was?
I'm fine with that.
Okay.
Yeah. Anybody okay. wants to know specifics, I'm more than happy to tell you. I just, you know, department chair of kinesiology at San Francisco State and a professor in the area of exercise physiology. That's my specialization.
My background, as already was covered really pretty well, is my career has been largely focused on the intersection between storytelling and technology. So I was a video game writer and editor at the New York Times Company for several years. And then with Booklamp, which was the company that was being talked about earlier, it was applying machine learning and big data to extraction of meta information from the full text of a book via computers. And then now VR is another form of intersection between storytelling and technology. So that's where I approach this from, but possibly my biggest qualification for the conversation today is that I do something that most people don't do right at the moment, but I think will change over time, which is I get up on a regular basis and I exercise in the morning in virtual reality. So that's part of what we're here to talk about. We both work with the Virtual Reality Institute of Health and Exercise, which exists to create rating systems for video games, VR games, based upon the amount of calorie or energy burn that you expect to during typical play. But we're talking about it from two different angles. One is why this needs to exist, like why are we doing this? And another one then is kind of what we're doing and what are we finding in the data. So about a month ago, we launched this website, which is intended to publish these ratings. So if you're familiar with like the ESRB ratings, like E is for everyone, or like movie ratings, like R-rated movies, the VR exercise ratings are designed to be somewhat similar, at least based on a similar concept, where we, except for looking at the content to figure out if it's appropriate by age, we're looking at it by saying in the average minute of typical play, how many calories can you expect to burn? One of the issues that we've run into a lot of times is people don't have very good mile markers or milestones for figuring out where exactly they are in the exercise spectrum, especially in VR, which, as you'll learn, we're finding people don't report that they're aware of the amount of exercise they're actually getting. And so afterwards, when you ask them how much they think they did, they're not very accurate. And so what we've been trying to do, and the whole purpose of the rating system, is to take virtual exercise and equate it to real-world known forms of exercise. So when Dr. Kern talks a little more about how we're actually going through and calculating the energy consumption of novel exercises, she'll talk more about that in detail. But in general, if in the lab we see somebody exerting effort that is equivalent of being on elliptical, then we rate that game as an elliptical equivalent. The majority of games, certainly the majority of traditional games and the majority of seated VR, still qualify in the resting category, right? This is can be fun and it can be engaging, it can be social, but not a lot of movement. On the other end of the spectrum, especially with our games that are designed for room scale VR, what we can find is that there's actually quite a bit of movement, or can be. Kind of unofficially, I estimate that roughly 30% of room scale games are equipped to elliptical equivalent or better. I can't say that definitively because we haven't rated all of them yet, but mm-hmm. just judging from the types of games that tend to score in that range and the kind of games that are coming out, that's in what we think. And the highest rated game in our system, a boxing game called Thrill of the Fight, actually is not only scores higher in the metabolic score than traditional boxing, but is actually the competitive is equivalent to sprinting, which is one of the higher exercise difficulties that we measure. So, but why do we measure this? Is what I want to start with. Right? Why does the VR Health Institute need to exist at all? And why is this relevant? Are you raising your hand? Or oh, cool, sweet. Go ahead.
So if in a horror game your heart is racing, there's like a flight or fly response to stop burning calorie significant.
Dr. Kern, do you want to answer
that? Could you repeat the question?
Question was, if like, you're playing a horror game and your heart rate is accelerated because you're scared, is that also burning calories?
That's a good question, and that was one of the things that actually I think brought Aaron to the lab to try and get this. You can see just out of that's just an adrenaline kind of surge, your oxygen consumption is going to go up, but it's not the same as if you were out running around the track. So we actually are measuring how much oxygen you consume during that kind of an activity. So we could dissociate the heart rate from an adrenaline response from actual oxygen consumption associated with metabolic data.
I see. Okay. So if it's a sitting game, but it's a horror game, your heart is racing, would you still rate that as a resting calorie?
No, it's still going to be a little more. You're still breathing heavy and doing things, but it's not going to be equated to probably what your heart rate is if you were out running and at that heart rate, because you have all the muscles moving.
Yeah.
So what we measure is actually the effect of that muscle contraction and consuming the oxygen associated with that.
Are you also going to talk a little bit about how you're going to assess, how you quantified all that?
We're going to do
it. Okay, cool.
Yes, we're doing both. And it makes me so happy that you asked about that because it means we've planned the right thing.
Yes.
to kind of reiterate that slightly. So the heart rate and correct me if I'm getting some of this wrong, my background is in psychology, actually, in industrial organizational psychology, and not the expert in the physiology side of things. But heart rate is a fairly good indirect measure in the right circumstances, but the things that affect heart rate are not just calorie consumption or calorie burn. So what we can say is when we have rated these games, if there's a game that's rated high as a high energy a calorie burner or high consumer of energy, then that is independent of the emotional state. That's purely driven off of what you're actually consuming. But it is possible to be playing a game that's very exciting and engaging and not be moving around much and have it kind of be a false predictor. So before we get to that, which I'm excited to get to as well, I want to talk a little bit about why we do this and why the considerations that we're trying to address with the VR Health Institute are things that make a technology adoption successful or not successful sometimes, and for when companies like Microsoft have a mission. My background, like I said, is in industrial organizational psychology. It's what I studied in university. And for a long time, I've been very fascinated with how social norms impact the adoption curve of technology. And so one of my favorite examples of this is very small, but it's very directly observed, so I like it, which is, so I was working at Apple when the Apple Watch was introduced. And Apple is very much a company that eats its own dog food. And so the people I worked with, we all tend to have Apple Watches. And if you think about what one of the roles of the Apple Watch is for, is it helps you have a kind of a discrete way of receiving messages and kind of being aware of what's going on around you without actually getting your phone out and disrupting the person you're talking to. The problem with this is that we already have social cues in our society for this, right? If you do a search for impatient on image search, you very quickly figure out what that cue is. If you take 10 people in a room, give them watches when they haven't had watches, and attach a device to it that pings them as a message device every 5 times an hour, what you have is an entire room that feels very impatient, very rushed. And so in some respects, I actually honestly believe that for the first month after the Apple Watch came out, our meetings got shorter because everybody was doing this all the time. And it's a signal that we do for impatience, right? VR has a sort of kind of impact as well. This is another one that I thought was interesting. So a few months ago, I was flying out here, and historically, my background is in more the higher-end VR units, like the Oculus Rift or the HTC Vive, and I was not very experienced with the mobile component of things. And so I wanted to change this, and so I went down to the store, and I bought a Galaxy 8, and I bought a Daydream, and I decided that I was going to watch a movie in a virtual movie theater on the next flight I had, which happened to be coming out here to Seattle. And so I did this, and two things happened that I thought were very amusing. One was that when I actually got to the point, sitting in the seat at the window and two people sitting next to me, when I actually got to the point where I had to get this thing out and put it on my face, I felt so uncomfortable. And I remember turning to the person and saying something like, I want to apologize. I've got this new cool thing. I'm going to try it out here, but it's going to be a little weird. I'm not trying to be antisocial, but... And the amount of pressure I felt socially to not do that was very interesting. The second thing is I was curious to see how the flight attendants treated me, right? So flight attendants are trained to when a passenger is distracted with different levels of interaction. So if I'm watching a movie with headsets on and they come by with the food service, they'll get your attention. But if you're asleep, they let you sleep, right? And I was curious which social norm would kind of be triggered with somebody with a thing strapped on their face, totally disconnected, clearly awake, but totally disconnected from the surrounding environment. And it turns out, if you are using VR on the plane, you do not get food, and you do not get drink. So just so you know. If you're curious about, and then play this video here in a second, probably because it's interesting, but also illustrates a point. If you want to experience the level of discomfort that I was experiencing on the plane, good news is you don't have to do it yourself. I have actually experienced this exact feeling before, and it was back in college after learning about the elevator studies where and I went and tried it. And the elevator studies back in the 60s were about group conformity. And the way you do it, if you want to feel this, is you go to an elevator, you go in, and you face backwards. So start face the back wall. And then don't move no matter who gets on, right? And after about 30 seconds, by the time the second person gets on, you will feel really, really weird. So let me show you a video they did of this back in the day, which I thought was...
The gentleman in the elevator now is a candid star. These folks who are entering, the man with the white shirt, the lady with the trench coat, and subsequently one other member of our staff, will face the rear. And you'll see how this man in the trench coat tries to maintain his individuality, but little by little, he looks at his watch, but he's really making an excuse for turning just a little bit more to the wall. Now we'll try it once again. Here's the candid subject. Here comes the candid camera staff, three of them at least. And this man has apparently been in groups before. Now, here's a fella with his hat on in the elevator. First, he makes a full turn to the rear, and Charlie closes the door. A moment later, we'll open the door. Everybody's changed positions. Now we'll see if we can use group pressure for some good. Now, in a moment, on Charlie's signal, everybody turns forward. There it is. Notice they take off their hats. And now, do you think we could reverse the procedure? Watch.
I feel so terrible for those people. because I would feel really uncomfortable in that environment. I think that this kind of thing is really an interesting example because it shows you how powerful our group expectations are. And I think that one of the reasons is that when you ask developers in VR and AR, which are the ones they can, you know, which we communally talk about as mixed reality here, right? That if you ask them which one they think is going to be the most likely massive mainstream adoption, AR regularly hits the top of the list. They say, well, when there's certain hurdles that are overcome, AR is going to be everywhere. And I think it's this, right? I have a hard time playing VR when somebody's at home with me, unless I have a reason not to. Like, I'm going to say, oh, I'm going to go exercise now. I'll be back in an hour. And I almost have to say, I'm leaving the room. I'm going to the gym. Because otherwise, I can't sit in the room when somebody else is in the kitchen and just block them out. And understanding kind of those impacts is interesting. And I think essential for understanding how people adopt technologies. So this is how the VR Health Institute, in a lot of ways, got started. The system that I use the most for my gameplay is the HTC Vive. And it's run on the back end by a system called Steam, which is one of the largest game distribution platforms on the market. And Steam has a nice feature is that it tracks and tells you how many hours you've been playing things. So for most of my life, this has kind of been a mixed sword, like a double-edged blade. On one hand, it's nice to know if I spent 30 hours playing a game that I spent $40 or $50 or $60 on, compared to a movie that's a pretty good investment per hour. On the other hand, it's kind of depressing to know that I spent like 300 hours doing basically nothing, or at least historically it's been viewed as basically nothing. But after a while, a few months after I got my Vive, I realized that I'd been playing Audio Shield for more than 100 hours. And Audio Shield is a rhythm game, right? And so basically you have a shield in each hand and these balls fly at you and you have to block them. It involves quite a bit of movement back and forth, and it can, at the higher levels, can be quite a lot of energy. And so I remember thinking to myself, you know, I feel like I'm exercising. I'm breathing hard, I'm sweating. If, in fact, this is exercise, my virtual reality system is by far the most effective exercise equipment I've ever owned. Because I've owned a rowing machine, I've owned an elliptical, and I've owned a treadmill, and I promise you I've never spent 100 hours on any of them. I probably cumulatively have never spent even close to 100 hours on all of them. Let me just really quick show you a video of when I talk about Audio Shield, what I mean in terms of there you go, this guy. So there's a little. This is the website for the VR Health Institute. It's a little introductory clip. I'm not going to play all of it. It's only about 2 minutes long. But there's a little section where it shows me kind of dancing around. And it's most people. A lot of time when people talk about exercise in VR, they think of a very stationary person. And I want to kind of give an accurate picture of what I'm talking about. And I apologize for the cheesiness of some of this.
After I got my first virtual reality system, I noticed that there was one game that I played for more than 150 hours. And I was sweating during this. I was feeling like I was getting exercise. Now 150
this
hours.
This is Audio Shield.
Ever used any piece of exercise?
I don't know if there's any actually more than that, but
from all the data that we have collected here in the lab, I can certainly say without a doubt that virtual reality is a form of exercise. We have some games that folks are tapping out close to their maximal capacity and enjoying it and having fun.
What we used was my Bob equivalent, trying to figure out what this person's above resting multiple of oxygen consumption is. So what you can compare this to is running outside. How much is this gaming session equivalent to that sort of thing? When I think of video games, I've always thought of this sedentary thing, you're at home in a couch and you're playing this game. That is the vision that I had throughout all these years of video games and kind of being proven wrong. I mean, I've looked at physiology and all these other things, and of course running, you'll get exercise. Of course, rowing and all these other activities will give you exercise, but now with the research we've shown, virtual reality games can do just as good.
The Virtual Reality Health Institute exists to create games based upon how much exercise they can be, because one of the problems is if you really do have a system that helps you burn calories at a rate that you don't perceive as being a lot, when even though it really is, the tendency is to get done with it and be like, well, I didn't really even exercise. And so, you kind of need an authoritative source to be able to say, yes, in fact, you did just exercise. That was a healthy thing for you to do. And you can do it again tomorrow and feel good about it.
So you got treated to more of that than I originally intended, but... now you have a sense of like the amount of movement that we talk about when we talk about a more active VR experience. We get to the point about why the VR health industry exists. So after I started noticing this was in fact something I thought was exercise at home, I bought a heart rate monitor. I ended up writing an article just taking and sorting from highest to lowest a number of different VR games that I thought might be good exercise. And we published it. I published it. And about 70% of the responses were very positive. And about 30% of the responses, I would say, were almost hostile, right? I mean, almost angry. So these are a few examples of the types of responses people get. Now, there's a lot of times these are paragraphs long, and this is a snippet out of the middle, but the sentiment is the same, right? So, dude, just go to a gym, get some air, meet some girls, feel good about yourself for a change, right? Another example, you know, this poster is looking for permission to avoid exercise. Those here supporting his delusion are harming him, not helping him. I know that it's like what it's like to get sweaty waving your arms around while using VR, and I know what it's like to exercise properly. Trust me, VR is not a suitable substitute for exercise, right? These are deeply ingrained perspectives that people have. And then there's ones that are actually, I think, are almost a little worse in some respects, which are what I refer to as like they're the yes but or calm down, nobody's saying that. And these are comments that tend to be left in response to somebody else's comment about how VR is not exercise. And it tends to be along the lines of it's better than nothing. Like they're going to be lazy gamers anyways, might as well do a little bit of activity, right? So the difference is going from a sedentary life to being semi-active. No healthy person is going to lose 20 pounds playing Echo Arena, which is a mid-range motion game. Good for him, though. The reason I include this, and I was tempted, but I couldn't do it because it would be, you know, wrong, replacing the Echo Arena with VR, because the rest of the comment before and after was certainly about VR as a whole. And this idea that, at best, you know, VR is going to be like a light walk. It's better. It's, you know, standing up, it's moving around, it's better than sitting down, but still not very helpful. And this kind of mentality is actually really pervasive and is very difficult to get out of, right? So about 2 weeks ago, the Wall Street Journal wrote an article about a series of gyms that are opening up, one in Columbus called VR Fit, and a number of others that are kind of exploring the space of having VR equipment in regular gyms. And the original article headline was, "Working Up a Real Sweat with VR." There was a video that was attached to it with a headline, "Can VR Tennis Get You Fit?" And then how that got ended up getting reported onto Reddit, which is a lot of times what I use as the proxy for what the community thinks, is your VR workout won't get you as fit as you think, right? So it started off as an article about how VR might be a tool that can help people promote exercise, and it gets translated down to a almost hostile and challenging statement about about how you are delusional almost to be thinking that you are gaining energy. And so why this happens is that we have been, spent years, years and years and years telling people this is the relationship between video games and health, right? I love this poster. I dislike this poster and love this poster at the same time. I think it summarizes a lot of the things that we've been telling gamers and the health community in general about video games, which is it's nothing, right? Do nothing, risk an early death. Games are bad. Games will kill you, right? And so this is a problem nowadays because... for the first time with the development of mixed reality, both the VR stuff now and what AR will become in the future, this thing that is incredibly powerful that we engage in on a regular basis can suddenly become something that's going to benefit us. And yet we have all this kind of social construct about how to keep that thing which beforehand was perceived as a negative from doing more harm. And we now need to get people to rethink that a little bit. I've found surveys that have reported that on average, the average American spends 6 hours a week playing video games, which is substantially more than the minimum recommended exercise requirements for Americans by the U.S. government. One of my favorite stats is that more than 35% of high school students play 3 hours a day after school. So they get off of school, they come home and play 3 hours a day. The reason I think that's a really interesting stat is the reason I know that stat is because it was collected by the Center for Disease Control when they're doing a study on the things that cause you to be at risk for early preventable death. And they identified video game playing as one of predictive characteristics, and so they asked that question. So we are deeply, deeply entrenched on one side of things. I know we have this cool and interesting technology that's coming along that can change that, and we need to figure out how to combine them. Yeah, go ahead.
Do those numbers, I presume that those numbers include mobile phone games, like the games on your phone?
I don't actually have to check.
And I'm curious to see, was there an increase in that number, if you know, over time? Because it seems like the availability of video games right now is also, people use games as a time waster between tasks or whatever. And so I'm curious whether that's reflected in the number, or is it really sedentary? Sitting down, I'm playing a game for an hour. It might have an impact, actually.
I don't know. I know the study was done around 2013, 2014.
Definitely in this smartphone.
So there is definitely, it's very possible. Another kind of component of that, which I think is really interesting, is if there's been some studies done on how like Pokemon Go has impacted how much people walk. And I don't have referenceable numbers off the top of my head, but it was a substantial increase that you had looked at somebody's walking distance before installing Pokemon Go versus after, and you clearly saw an increase in the amount of physical activity was going on. So I don't know about the mobile component of it, though, yeah. Moving along, so talk about in a second, like turning this over to Dr. Kern. So just out of curiosity, going back to like my 100 hours of Audio Shield and whether or not it was actually exercise, I mean, this isn't going to be a surprise considering the fact that the title of this talk was talking about the 150 million calories that have been burned in Audio Shield. But yeah, Steam Spy reports that roughly 693,000 hours, as of like 2 months ago when I collected the data, have been played by the Steam community in Audio Shield. And even if you take it from a very conservative standpoint, if you say things like, well, I think 25% of those total hours is somebody just leaving it on the floor and going and getting lunch, and an additional 25% of those hours is somebody browsing the menu, which is a lot more than people actually browse the menu when you watch them play, you still end up looking at the average burn in our studies for Audio Shield at the moderate intensity levels, and multiplying that out to equals more than 152 million calories. The upper end, if you're a little less conservative, is a range of 250 million calories. For comparison, the 150 is the equivalent of walking, running to and from the moon 4.8 times. Also, several hundred thousand hamburgers avoided eating. and so what I think is fascinating about this is that we are might be inadvertently building one of the largest tracked exercise communities in the world. This is one game out of an ecosystem, and I think it's totally possible that in 5 years, this could be so much larger than it is in terms of calories burned without the community ever really even thinking of itself as a community of exercisers. Yeah.
But based on those previous stats, I think that averages out to about 200 calories per hour. Is that right?
I don't know off the top of my head, but...
Well, I mean, just doing the simple division of, you know, the total number of hours played and the total calories consumed, that seemed to be about 200 calories an hour.
So
a little less than that for Audio Shield.
Okay.
That's a little high.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's also two components there. So you're right. That's on the lowest intensity. So a lot of times when the subjects came in, they were not familiar with Audio Shield. And it's a skill-based game. This is actually something that I expect to come up in the Q&A afterwards, which is how do you actually go out and figure out how to rate a game? When do you rate a game that changes experiences? How much experience do you let the players have before you rate them? So that was the average of inexperienced players in the study. I can tell you that my own personal, when I play, when I hook myself up to the metabolic cart, or when I am hooked up to the metabolic cart, it is... It actually produces the highest calorie burn per hour of any of the systems we've tested, including being competitive with uphill competitive mountain biking or like the Tour de France.
Roughly how many calories per hour?
I don't want to say. I mean, we can go and I can look it up and get back to you on. I just don't have it off the top of my head. I don't want to say the wrong thing.
No, for what that was it would average about 150.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so this is where I then turn it over because I'm not the one best qualified to talk about how to do this. So, Dr. Kern.
Thanks, Aaron. Okay, so the question was asked a little bit earlier, how do we assess this? So this is how we do it. It was very interesting. I found interesting anyways when Aaron first addressed me and asked if there was any way we could actually quantify exercise. And I said, well, sure. Yeah, all we got to do is hook them up to a metabolic cart and measure their oxygen consumption. And I guess, you know, being in the area of exercise physiology, I assume everybody knows that that's how you do these things. But no, that not everybody does. So what we ended up saying to do, maybe we don't have that anymore.
Nope.
There we go. This is kind of a picture showing you of what happens when we bring somebody into the lab. And these are some students. That's Dulce, who you heard talking a minute ago. This was data that we collected for her master's thesis and other faculty and folks who were demonstrating the whole thing. Here is a mask. Putting that on, we will collect all of your oxygen and all of your CO2. And we can quantify how many breaths you take, what the volume of air you move, and then that is hooked up to a metabolic cart that actually will tell you the percentage of oxygen and the percentage of CO2 in both the incoming, we know what room air is, but on your expired side. So we did that and then added the HTC Vive goggles, which you can see over here on Angelina, on top of that and had them play the games. And we did this for 41 different individuals, 21 guys, and 20 women. So we looked at three different games, as the already star of the show, Audio Shield, Hollow Point, which as you can tell is an archery game, and you've got things coming at you, and you've got to duck and go around and be aware. And then the last one there, the big caloric expenditure event is the thrill of the fight, which you can see is a boxing game. You can kind of see what's going on here. So you're ducking, getting out of the way, you're throwing punches. And that one ended up being the one that really got people going. So before we did this, we actually measured them first on a treadmill, exercising classically, doing what is called a VO2 max test. So if any of you have ever done that and have a familiarity with what kind of a thing, if any of you have ever had a heart attack, they make you do these things, but they keep it at a very low key. Looking at VO2 max is one of those things that we look at for someone's overall cardiovascular fitness. It is considered the gold standard. And if you're hooked up to a metabolic cart, then you get to do all those measurements as well. Not just looking at the max heart rate, but also looking at the amount of oxygen you can consume. So we did that first for every one of these subjects and had a benchmark. This is what their max capacity is. Then we threw them up on those three games a couple of days later after they revamped from the max test and measured the same things. And then we were able to say what percentage of that maximal capacity they were working at for each one of these games. This is an example, the kind of printout you'd see on the metabolic cart. So this is starting out, and this is Aaron's data. Since he had a copy of that on his own thing, it was easy to put the slide in here. This is him playing Audio Shield, but playing Audio Shield that's been on testosterone. It's been ramped up. He's played Audio Shield for so long, the regular game is not, so he's bumped it 3 and 4 times. So he is way up here on Audio Shield, which you'll find on the next couple of slides is one of our lower rated games. And then the other two, we didn't actually quantify in the study, but it is
Knockout League,
which is a very popular game. So we had him exercise for 10 minutes, then rest for 5, get back close to what his resting metabolic rate was, not quite, still left over from playing, play a second game, and we looked at the average score in the last 5 minutes of the game. So they got up and into what we call in the exercise a steady state. So you don't want to do things when things are all in transition. You want them to be at a nice constant. Even though this game you're moving around and doing stuff, if you were able to maintain that, then we'd say that's the metabolic cost for that period. And then he came back down and rested again, and then turned around and did the same thing back and forth. On your left-hand side, VE is ventilation. RF is respiratory frequency, so number of breaths. So it's a breath-by-breath system, collecting every single one. And then on the other panel, we've got oxygen consumption, or VO2, and then VCO2. So from those things, we could actually calculate what kind of fuel you're using when you exercise. So here's the compiled data from Dolce's thesis, actually, looking at rest values, thrill of the fight, Audio Shield, and Hollow Point, those three games that you saw people dancing around and doing on the screens. And we put all the data together, separated out men and women, those who had been gamers and considered themselves gamers versus people who had never done any gaming before, it's the first time they ever came in, just to see if there was some big difference between the two. In general, the results were pretty much the same between everybody in that thrill of the fight was by far the highest oxygen consumer for any one of the populations. Then Audio Shield was the lowest in the white bar. And lastly, Hollow Point was kind of up and down. That's more of a skill game, doing this archery thing and getting it to go. You know, people are laughing a lot because they're missing things and it's coming back at you and all of those things. And in particular, if you look at the differences between the gamers versus the non-gamers, those things. But the energy expenditure is up there. 10 to 15, or 10, on average, the error bars are there, but 10 to 12 kcals per minute. Yeah?
Is the fact that the female consumptions are lower than males a natural expected thing? Okay, so just physiological factor?
Yeah. Kcals per minute is a calculation that's done on liters of oxygen per minute. So we usually look at everything in relative terms. The previous slide had milliliters of oxygen per kilogram body weight, so it's a relative term. But to get the calculation into kcals, you have to go back to just absolute liters to then multiply it out. And since women are usually smaller than men, we end up with a smaller number of calories. Good question. It's one of the questions I use on most of my exams. They have to figure out, why would the women be less? We can change that into the kind of measurement that Aaron was talking about, metabolic equivalence, trying to put this into terms that people will understand and talk about multiples of resting metabolism. So these are called METs in the exercise physiology world, metabolic equivalence, and they have a range. The American College of Sports Medicine has set all of these things up, and given whatever those numbers come out to, they have qualifications. That's vigorous exercise if it's something between 7.5 to 10 METs, and that's where thrill of the fight landed. If it's between 4.5 to 7, then that's considered moderate exercise. So this would be exercising 5 to 7 times your resting metabolic rate. In numbers, that equates to 3.5 milliliters of oxygen per kilogram body weight per minute. So if you have 4 of those, you're up to 14, 5, 17.5. Most of the people that we saw in the study, young college-aged individuals, had VO2 maxes in the area of the high 30s to mid-50s. So these guys were exercising in a pretty good range, 50, 60% of their maximal capacity, which would quantify them into the vigorous category. The last thing that we did in the study was actually ask people if they thought they were exercising. And if they were, what level did they think they were exercising? Were they exercising really hard? Was it mild exercise? You know, how would you compare that? So this is just the subjective information that you get from the person. Even though we measured them as exercising on a vigorous based on their metabolic data, even during thrill of the fight, the numbers that we got, all participants, males, females, gamers, non-gamers, they thought they were exercising moderately. They were sweating like pigs out there. And they were, you know, the whole thing's, it's like getting very nasty. But no, as far as they were concerned, they were having fun. They were having a good time. And even though they were doing this, the best thing, they say, oh, no, that was light. That wasn't really like I was out running in the hills. Yeah.
Do you have data for, in comparison, what the rating of, like, running, sprinting, swimming are?
Sure. Yeah, most of that data is very old and all published stuff. Uh-huh. As far as, are you talking about the metabolic cost data, VO2?
Just the ratings of perceived experience.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
In their own ratings.
In their own ratings, when they do the max test, thing I was talking about on the treadmill where they're going to their maximal capacity, you ask them at every stage before you go up, where are you? And it's a scale, it's called the Borg scale, named after Dr. Borg, who created it in the 60s, that goes from 6 to 20. And it actually correlates very highly to what your heart rate is. People never knew that, but that's how he made the scale. And so you start off, you know, you're walking and so forth. Well, how do you feel? On a scale of nothing to I'm going to die. And they're pointing, you know, 7 at the beginning. And the next stage, they go, oh, that's a light workout, 9. Then you get to the moderate where there's now jogging at a fairly good pace. And they'll say, yeah, that's hard exercise. And then you get up another couple of stages. And all of a sudden, they're down here at 18, 19. And when they get close to the 19 and 20, we're looking at all the metabolic markers and we know. So we have their own perceived exertion for that activity. But for this activity, when they're doing it, based on that familiarity with the Borg scale, those were the numbers they gave us. So nobody gave us any numbers higher than 14 for how hard they were working, even though their oxygen consumption was very close to what their maximal capacity was.
So their bodies are experiencing the same thing, but their minds are experiencing completely different things.
That would kind of be our premise. At least it looks that way.
Something like distraction or...
Yeah, exactly. You've got your mind doing something else and you don't even realize that you're really exercising.
I think there's also another field of health research in VR that's going on about like pain management.
Yeah.
So what they've found is that like burn victims who have to have dressings changed 3 times a day, it's a very difficult form of pain to manage because you can't just generally drug yourself up the entire time and local anesthetic can be too powerful. And so it's historically been a difficult one, and so they've found that there is a reduction in perceived pain if somebody's in VR when that bandage is being changed. And I think it's probably, whatever the mechanism is, I think it's probably a similar mechanism. It's a level of a perception of level of discomfort. Mm-hmm. And if your brain is engaged in something else, or again, I don't know the mechanism, mm-hmm. but if you are not paying attention to it somehow, it seems to translate. And I'm hesitant to name numbers off it, but I was actually just reading an article the other day that found that the pain reduction has been self-reported by the patients as being stronger than that of morphine for VR treatments. So,
yeah, there's a gentleman who's actually doing that up at UCSF, and he contacted me when he saw some of the articles that have come out in the newspaper and everything else and said, oh, can we work together on these things? But we're looking at the exercise component, but I understand exactly where the idea is coming from. So those were really interesting findings. As far as the first time we'd actually quantified or tried to quantify the results of using some virtual reality for exercise. So here is using, again, that metabolic equivalent score for different activities, and these are things, again, that are published data, people have quantified the cost of vacuuming the floor, quantified the cost of you know, washing your car. There's tables of data for activity. People wear activity trackers and then collect oxygen consumption. And so what we have kind of highlighted there on the red bars, the games that we've looked at so far, we've looked at a number of other ones, and here was where Wii Fit came into play. So these guys are already miles above where Wii Fit had gotten. And I think, as Aaron would probably say, one of the nice things is most of these games you can change as your skill level changes. You don't have to go out and buy a new thing. It's kind of an added bonus to the whole prospect. Yeah.
Yeah, just because of the question camp earlier, this particular number was from the higher intensity levels of Audio Shield. So
that were, yeah, his own data.
Ninja is the VR version, not the phone version?
Correct.
Okay.
Which is exactly like the phone version, except for you have swords in your hand.
Okay.
So, that's our contention, is that maybe this is not really they're perceiving that they're exercising as much, and also maybe they're having fun, and maybe they'll come back and do it again, whereas a lot of times that's not the case. So one of the things we have tried to do, and we've only done it once, but we're going to do it again this Friday, on the San Francisco State campus, just recently, a new facility, the Mashouf Wellness Center, was built. Yeah?
Have you accounted for the novelty effect? In other words, how familiar people are with these things, and does the... Because
does it wear off?
It does wear off, right?
We haven't collected that much data. The only person I can talk to is him, and it doesn't seem to wear off with him
I think it's a well known effect also in gyms, right? Like you start off, you're motivated, you get on a program, and then like going the second, the fifth, and
then the first
month later down the road,
compliance is a huge, huge issue.
So if I can, I don't have data for that, right? But that is actually the entire premise of the question about whether or not this is actually a more effective form of exercise, and is the basis for when I said, for myself at least, that the VR has been the most effective exercise equipment I've ever owned, is because I've continued to use it. I think everything has that fall off, right? I actually compare that same curve to my Xbox and my PS4, which is when I buy a new game, I will play that game a lot in the first few weeks, and then over time I'll play it less, and eventually it's decreased to zero. The difference is between that and my exercise equipment is that it resets every time I buy a new experience. And so possibly one of the most powerful things about VR is not so much that it's possible to get a variety of exercises out of it, but that it has an incredible diversity in types of experiences you can choose from. And you know, like if I could pay $50 a month and buy a new game, and that would keep me interested in going to the gym, quote unquote, in a way that I have not been historically interested in doing, I would find that to be an amazing value. And so the hypothesis is that's what we're moving towards. If it's not there yet, that we will eventually, these technologies will develop into these tools that solve so many of the issues that keep people from exercising on a regular basis, that being one of them.
But yeah.
I also wonder how it compares to some of the more social forms of exercises like
spin
classes and spin classes and things like that, where they don't have just internal motivators, they're externally motivated. There's a coach kind of yelling just a few more hills or whatever, right? And the social component of, or the dance component in some of the dance exercises, right, must be something like that as well. So it's an interesting one too.
Which helps you to get more engaged.
But also probably it has the similar effects where you're focusing on the music and focusing on the the thrill of the experience, whatever that might be, and you might actually rate your level of exercise similarly lower on aggregate than if you're just like on a treadmill running and your mind is focused only on running. And you just want to shoot yourself because you don't like running.
Yeah. Yeah.
We have a concept that we refer to that we've talked about recently is the painless minute of exercise. That in a lot of ways what I'm searching for, and I think a lot of people are searching for, is that moment when you're exercising and you're not thinking about the exercising. And the different types of exercise have a different percentage of painless minutes. So you give me a treadmill without a TV, the amount of time minutes I spend thinking about running on the treadmill is pretty high, especially at the end of it when I'm tired. You give me with a TV and a highly interesting Netflix show, it's a higher number percentage of the minutes are painless because I'm engaged in that. But I think, in a way, what the potential of the VR stuff is it has the potential to be the highest number of painless minutes possible in experience. If you find something you're engaged in that also makes you perceive as less exercised, you play longer.
I think it would probably compare well to group sports. If you end up playing soccer, you're pretty much continuously sprinting and running, but your focus is definitely not on sprinting and running, and you're not thinking about this as, I mean, yes, in retrospect, you're thinking about it as exercise, but it's about, let's win, let's score, let's blah, blah.
You're distracted in some way.
Well, it's a game, right? You're there with your teammate. I don't know. There's other components to it.
You're not there to run. You're there to get the ball and score a goal, right?
Sure.
Yeah. Running is a consequence of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, explain to me why people don't come back and defend.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Explain why people don't come back and defend in soccer.
Because they like to score goals.
You just stand there. You don't swing back. Sprint forward. Stay there.
Exactly.
Yeah. We digress.
But no, the novelty aspect is definitely a good one, and that we did ask some folks when we went to this. This is kind of the next phase of what we're going to, beside continuing to rank other games and give them ratings, so that way folks can. And on the VR Institute website, if you've created a game, you can give us that game, and we'll rate it if we see it's going to be a valuable fitness kind of a game, and give it a ranking, give it a badge with a number on it. But we also wanted to find out if we could do some fitness classes with this. And would that be something that people would be interested in doing? And so last Wednesday evening, we took the unit down to this brand new health center that we've got on the state campus. It was just opened a month and a half ago. So unfortunately, they don't even have any great pictures up at their website, but the architectural drawing of the thing. But this is right inside the foyer, and we set up the whole VR headset and just ask students as they walk by, hey, have you ever tried VR? Would you like to see if this is any exercise? Just do it for 5 minutes or something. And nobody was doing it at first. And then the next thing you know, everybody was in line and they all wanted to see what was going on. And so as a result, they did. And the kind of cool thing was there's a circular staircase that goes up to the second floor. People just started standing around here and watching and seeing what was going on, and next thing you know, here's the line forming out, and they all wanted to see what it was like. Nice. Very exciting. The folks there, we had to convince them a little bit in the gym. If we were able to get this equipment here, would you guys be interested in having these classes? Do you think the student body would be interested? And sure enough, they pretty much said they were. We asked them some questions, just kind of really brief questionnaire, obviously, if it was available at your gym, how likely would it be that you would come to a VR class? If you look at the numbers here, the 29 out of the 37 that actually had answered, and this is a combination of data from a place that actually is a VR gym, Fit Gym, VR Fit, and what we collected there at the Michoud Center. And so it's promising to see that they would do that. Other questions that, of course, people like 24-Hour Nautilus or 24 Fitness would want to know, how much would you be willing to pay to come to a VR fitness class and get that kind of data for them? Then they may actually help support doing this kind of research. But that's kind of where we are at this point in time. And I'm glad you guys have asked questions throughout the whole process. But if you have any more, please, we'd be more than happy to answer.
I'm going to stand back up again.
Yes, stand on back up. Any ideas? Where would you see this kind of stuff going? Or do you think, trying to address the novelty aspect? I mean, if we do this as a fitness class, then obviously we'll be able to see how many people come back and come back again. And do you find this more intriguing form of exercise than the classic forms of exercise? Yeah, Mark.
Yeah, I wonder how would you scale this? So at the moment you're kind of running a study pair, game, but there are potentially millions of games out there. You cannot rank all of them. Can you scale this?
We've already started, yeah. But go ahead.
One of the things that works in our favor in that case is that most VR games are probably not really great candidates for exercise. So we've had to make a number of assumptions in the ratings, and this is actually another interesting thing. When I mentioned earlier, how do you go about rating games that might not be the same in the first 15 minutes versus the last 15 minutes? Are so heavily influenced by how you play, like if you play with like this or are you punching at things? One of the assumptions we made is that the people who are interested in the exercise ratings are people who are proactively looking for experiences that are beneficial to them. So if a game is going to be clearly rated as resting, it's probably requires less attention from us than if the game could be somewhere between the walking or elliptical range and the peak. So right there, you get to narrow your focus a lot. And then the second thing is that we get to then take advantage of the fact that we happen to be near a student body that's engaged and interested in this sort of stuff. And so we're putting together processes now where we have students come in, we get their baseline data, we benchmark that against heart rate data from a trusted meter monitoring device, which they can send home with them. And that way, if you have a first-generation game, somebody submits it, and you think it's likely to be high-quality exercise but not sure, then we can have them do a preliminary test at home, and if it qualifies, we can have them come in and do a full metabolic test. And so we can outsource a lot of it and then really just focus in detail on the...
Yeah, we actually had really hoped that there were going to be... again, last week, we had a meeting for students who were interested. And all the students who came and thought this would be really cool because they did read on the little caption that they would get these games to test at home free of charge. So that sells a lot of games right there, a lot of interest right there. And there was pizza. So that two things. You do this for students, it's wonderful. But they of those people that came in, only one of them has his own VR setup that we could use for this study already. And we're not going to buy them all. The whole set, right. The headsets, or
it is an early
computer
market, for sure.
Yeah, it's there. Yeah.
So with the boxing game, for example, if you were to compare that to a multiplayer version where the opponent is not a bot but is actually another human in another VR setup, maybe in a different room, mm-hmm. Do you expect either of your core results to change, which is the number of calories burnt and the perceived pain level?
Okay, I have not played those games. You have.
I've actually thought about that quite a bit. And the reason why is because I was curious about why it is that the thrill of the fight could outperform in the metabolic score traditional boxing, real-world boxing. And my hypothesis on that is that there's a lot of other things that you do in real-world boxing, like trying not to get hit, that you don't have to worry about nearly as much. There's also pauses between rounds. There's, mm-hmm. might be broken up for a period of time while somebody recovers. So I don't know. I would expect it to be similar, maybe a little less, because I think if you have two players that are both humans, the cadence might be slightly different, right? They might not both constantly doing this. You might jog around a lot more. You might dodge more. I don't even know. I don't know for sure if that would be an increase or decrease. I mean, a lot of times, if you want to look at this a different way, if you record somebody playing Thrill of the Fight and how many times they duck, and you count each one of those as a squat, which they essentially are, you can start saying, okay, how many squats is this going to be in a given exercise period? Mm-hmm. And would that go up or would it go down if you're fighting a real human? I don't know. I think largely comparable if two were equally skilled.
We haven't done any of those multiplayer games, yeah. But students have commented. And I think that would be one of the cool things doing a fitness class if we had these students in a room this size and they're play areas set up and have them playing. Aaron has mentioned one game that's kind of like a capture the flag game. And two people are working together, but they got to dodge behind this and go around that and all these other kinds of things. I think it could be really exciting and fun. And
If I can, to add on to that, so your comment earlier about VR can be what you make it. In a lot of ways, right? And the type of exercise experience you give to a player mm-hmm. is widely variable depending on what the player wants to do and how you kind of engineer that experience. So can social, like, in this game, will the social component drive people to try harder and get higher exercise? I think absolutely. In some games, will the competitive version of it be less because they're trying to spend more time strategically aligning themselves? Probably sometimes, right? I think with a computer-controlled player, you can do some really, really cool things, right? For example, there's a group that's that I work with down in San Francisco, and they're just now starting on what's called a game that we're referring to internally as Dungeon. So Dungeon with a G-Y-M, Jim. And the whole purpose of Dungeon is really to build a game that is fun, compelling, that you level up, that's multiplayer cooperative. You can go dungeon questing together. I would love a world where I could go to a gym with my friends to go raid a camp. right?
Sold it.
Yeah, I mean, like, there's a lot of. I remember a long time ago when I was at a conference once when I wrote in the game industry, where I was talking to a researcher who researched game addiction, and it was surprising to me because one of the things he told me is game addiction doesn't exist, and which is odd considering mm-hmm. he studied it. And he said, we misunderstand a lot of times what game addiction is. If you take out the games that have no multiplayer component to it, there's very little evidence that people have the classic game addiction of going into the basement and excluding the outside world and not having the social contacts. So where you find game addiction is really much more like internet addictions, where people replace their real world outside connections with in-game real life connections. Mm-hmm. So they have friends in the game in lieu of having friends in real life. And this speaks to the incredible power of kind of these social networks, right?
Yeah.
And obviously you don't want to necessarily addict people to a game through social networks, but if you can figure out a way to use that power to lead to healthy lifestyles, that's really powerful. With Dungeon and with other games, right, one of the key pillars of its design is throughout the design process, we measure for calorie burn. So let's say you have a monster, and he's big, and he's designed to take 2.5 to 3 minutes to defeat, and he's got points on him that you have to hit and move around a lot, and we can calculate out. This is, okay, we expect you to burn 35 to 40 calories per monster. If you want to do an exercise routine, we'll generate a dungeon for you that can hit a certain target. Also, if you wear a heart rate monitor, which can then feed back to a server and inform the game, you can target heart rate bands, right? So the monsters can be harder or easier, depending on what you need, as it's reactive. It's an interactive and reactive design. And then also you can do things like progression. So say you wanted to have a 12-week exercise program. Well, you have a dungeon that's 12 levels deep. You have progression of power-ups and tools and all the various things you have in a regular game, but you're crafting that in a community experience. And after a while, that's not everybody's experience, but there will be people who will really, really enjoy that. And there's going to be a variation of that, I think, for lots of different people, and that's the power of it.
Yeah.
What do you think about the chance for injury with a lot of repetitive motion? I think with so many games, VR games coming out I expect it to be like PC gaming nowadays. It's going to be a lot of quick games. The developers won't have time to study the physiology or the ergonomics of the movement, and perhaps you have like really good chances for injury if you just no guidance on movements. And for people just like, it's like they had like wrist injuries with like a lot of flicking. Mm-hmm. So how do you, what do you think about that? And how do you?
No, it's a great question. Thank you. I don't think that anybody has studied any physiology associated with the games from what little review of literature. There are a couple people that have looked at heart rate during the different games. And you're right about the Wii Fit getting injuries because they were doing repetitive motion kind of activities. I haven't, in the games that we've looked at in the lab anyway, there hasn't been any real repetitive motion kind of things that people would go through, even if they were playing it for several hours. Aaron did mention when we were driving over here about a friend who actually had a mild heart attack because he played for 4 hours straight, and he really shouldn't have done that, and nobody told him not to. But it's kind of like you got to say, okay, maybe we have to put a disclaimer on some game that you could really get yourself going. If you're at risk for disease and you have this, maybe you need to get your physician to clear you before you actually start using this as a mode of exercise, just like any other kind of exercise.
This is not related to the actual physiology, but it's more about the psychology of labeling mm-hmm. games with marking them as strenuous versus not. Mm-hmm. Do you actually feel like that you might inadvertently cause some games not to be popular if you label them super strenuous, right? Like, because most people, you know, look at the, most people are not exercise nuts, right? And uh-huh. and look at for the game, they might not want to have a game that's yeah. super strenuous in there. And like you said, most of these games actually have ranges, right? They have a beginner sure. level to the ultimate level. So in some sense, labeling something as strenuous is might be a negative signal rather than a positive signal. And I'm wondering if you considered ranges rather than a label. Like this game varies from whatever, easy to moderate or whatever, rowing to swimming or I don't know.
Well, the badges have a small range. It's just 1 to 2, 3 to 4, because that's kind of what we saw in the games that we've got. So there's a small range in there. I don't know if we have a little disclaimer down at the bottom saying it could. Yeah.
Yeah. So
I'd forgotten.
I will say, so this is, again, one of those kind of philosophical, and I see you trying
yes,
to move us
time
along.
To go.
Sorry, Mark.
But again, it goes back to some of the assumptions. I actually think there's a bit of a selection bias or self-selection process will happen, is the people who are interested in the ratings at all will be people who are looking for games that are higher intensity. And if you're not interested in it, then that's probably not the characteristic you're keying off of. I don't think that there's much downside to a game kind of publicizing to the people who are interested in it that it can be good exercise. And the people I think who, it's kind of like ASRB ratings now, right? If I care about content, those ratings could theoretically distract, like guide me towards or away from getting content. But I haven't looked at one of those ratings in a long time because I'm not the demographic anymore that cares.
But I'll flip that around. I think that actually ratings matter a lot. Like movie industry goes through hoops to get a particular, not get an R rating, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And they'll modify the movie and the storyline to not get an R rating.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that might actually, down the road, you might actually have games or game designers that are designing games specifically not to be super strenuous to get not as, I mean, I think it's a great problem to have.
Yeah, I was going to say, if it ever gets to the point that enough people care about exercise in VR that that's a problem, then that's a huge step forward. But, and also, that's an interesting discussion that we can have offline. But I think when you inform people about what they're looking for, designers or consumers, mm-hmm. they get to figure out what they're looking for,
sure.
right? And so I don't think there's anything negative about a designer saying I'm a target. In fact, I would actually argue you absolutely, as a designer, if you're in VR and you don't know the difference between designing a game to exhaust you in 30 minutes versus when you can play for an hour and a half without exhausting you, you are kind of overlooking a big characteristic of VR development or AR development. You should have in your mind your target goals because they can be opposites. Designing a game for good exercise is not necessarily a good thing if you're designing a game that's different.
Thank you very much for your talk. I think it sparked many conversations here. We'll take them offline now. Thank you also for the people who were probably on their offices watching your talk. And I think you're going to be around during the day so mm-hmm. other people can catch up with you guys. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.